Hello, this is Peter Davison. You're listening to Gallifrey Public Radio.
I'm Josh Liston from On The Bubble Podcast, an oral history of television fandom, part of the Gunner Geek Network, just like the show you're checking out now. Shows on the network are individually owned and opinions expressed may not reflect others. Find other awesome geeky shows at gunnergeeknetwork.com.
Dialed into Gallifrey Public Radio. We're a podcast dedicated to positive enjoyment of everything in the Doctor Who spectrum. Join us for weekly discussions ranging from Hartnell to Whittaker and well beyond. Your hosts are Jay Witten.
I choose Death by Scotland.
Keir Hansen.
Arun, Arun, Arun.
Charles Martin.
I got their first album, The Salty Butter.
And Haley Malley.
I used to be right next to a train track.
We travel through classic and new Who, explore the extended Whovian universe, and play a few games from time to time if we're left unsupervised. Oh, and a word on spoilers, we do discuss recent news, content that has been officially released, and the occasional interesting rumor, but don't worry. If we look too far into the future, we'll give you fair warning.
Welcome to episode 317 of Gallifrey Public Radio, where it doesn't even matter if you're a human kid or a centuries-old Time Lord, the rule remains the same. Remember to close the door! What, were you born in a barn? I'm Charles.
I'm Keir.
I'm Jay.
And I'm Haley. This week, we're back to our rewatches, or watches, of classic Doctor Who episodes, opening season 14 with Tom Baker and Elizabeth Sladen in Mask of Mandragora. In it, we play a bit of inverse 15th century Italian chess, where the longer you play, the more pieces are added to the game. At least we don't have to remember all of their names. Thank Dimnos.
So, yeah.
Praise Dimnos!
Praise him. Yeah, and then we can all dance around in that perfect circle that was very reminiscent of the choreography that the Sisterhood of Karn had around the Eternal Flame. But anyway, so we are finally back to our classic rewatches. We will get to a bunch of them this year. This year.
Yeah.
Just stretch that.
Year in a bit.
Year in a bit. Year in a bit. Although if the Doctor Who Appreciation Society is to be believed, they are back in principle production for Series 12. I don't
quite... Yeah.
The only thing I believe about that is maybe they're working on some sets or building some costumes. But for what, I don't know, because I don't think anybody's necessarily written anything. Anyway, we're getting ahead of ourselves.
I saw the photo, the whole production.
I will debunk that photo. I'm sorry. I got to pull a chain on this because before you even get started. Okay, so you think that photo was accurate and that was what they were actually working on? So you think it's summertime in Cardiff and they're all out there in summer dresses and shorts in the sunshine on in the first week of January in Wales?
Hold on, Keir. Are you trying to tell me they don't film on other planets?
What? They were outside their filming hangar in that photo. I'm sorry. Right. I call
you're right.
Baloney.
Maybe they're like scrubbing the sets or something. Like they had a rap party and somebody had to clean up a bunch of puke.
Yeah, right. Which explains why they were all wearing Jodie's shirt, which they did at the rap party last year. Anyway, okay. Back to the topic. Okay, so we always like to make sure that we do a quick familiarity check and go around the table and make sure, see how familiar people are with this particular story. So we're back, as I mentioned, back the crest, the beginning of season 14, Fourth Doctor, Sarah Jane, really in the thick of it. Haley, how many times have you seen this story?
One.
Excellent.
Not even a rewatch.
Well, she corrected herself in the intro exactly for that point. And what was your overall impression? Just a high altitude. Okay.
I mean, it seemed like a very typical Doctor Who episode story.
Okay. As far as just, ticking all the necessary boxes. Got it.
Yeah.
Okay. Jay?
Seen it at least once before, probably twice or so, but this was one of the first classic stories that I ever came across.
Okay. All right. Interesting that you note that. I'm going to get to that in a second. And just as far as now that getting a chance to watch it through in earnest with intent, how did the story strike you?
It was fun. I'd rank it like definitely top half. But as far as like anything beyond that, I don't know. It's
okay.
I'd have to give it some more thought.
All right. Well, hopefully you'll formulate a little more gel on that as we go through this conversation. When we get to the last segment where we talk about our rewatchability, you can be definitive about it. I like the fact that you said this was one of your earliest exposures to the classics, because I think I keep trying to remember when back in the early 80s when I had seen some stuff pop up on PBS and a Star Trek fan friend of mine, grade school, primary school, said, oh, this is the show that comes on, I forget, on our local PBS, whether it came on before or after he tuned into Trek. He had the UHF dial memorized and would clip to everything right on time. But
UHF! Old school.
But our local station was, as many were at the time, notorious for showing them asynchronously. Sometimes you'd get Davison, sometimes you get Baker, back to back. It was really difficult to follow unless you knew what you were watching, which most Americans at the time didn't. So a lot of these images struck me as familiar, but I don't know which one was. This could potentially be one of the first Who episodes, I couldn't even tell you which one because it's just fragments of a really jacked up memory. My memory even of last week is patchy, but it's somewhere in there, because I mean there are some iconic appearances, you know, the look of Baker, you know, throwing the hood off and the you know, the big grin, you know, it's me after all, or the sword fighting and things like that. The period costumes, you know, really stand out because this was a very particular, that 15th century look is so you know, so unique. Okay, Charles, you've got an interesting anecdote to go with this as far as your familiarity with the story.
Before I get to that, though, I'm going to agree with both Jay and Haley that this is a lot of people in the rose-colored tint of their memories think of this as one of the best Doctor Who stories, and it is Doctor Who firing on all of its cylinders in the 70s, absolutely. Mm-hmm. But it's actually not even the best story in the season. So I would call it a B story, but a perfect B, right?
Okay. Yeah.
But the reason I have, and I've seen it at least 25 times, many times.
Okay.
But the reason that I have such a strong attachment to it, as longtime listeners will know, was that this was a story that I picked when I was dating the woman who later became my wife. Because if you're going to date me, then you've got to be okay with Doctor Who, because you are going to be a Doctor Who widow and when it's on. And so so I needed to pick a story. Remember, the new series wasn't on yet. Mm. Even the Paul McGann series. Even the Paul McGann TV movie was just a twinkle in somebody's eye.
Right.
So I had to pick a story that I thought encapsulated Doctor Who. So it had some science-y element. It had some past element. It had what I consider still to be the best duo companion team, Tom Baker and Liz Sladen. And no background baggage, so no Dalek stories, no old monsters, nothing that where you needed to know some history in order to enjoy it.
Hmm.
And this was the one that I picked, and it worked. 22 years later, we're still married.
Hmm. Sometime we're going to have to delve a little deeper and try and pick your brain as to what else was on that list, you know, as far as meeting those particular criteria.
I remember City of Death was on the list.
Mm. We'll for definitely sure. get into that sort of thing. I mean, in this, we all seem to sort of be, I know we're sort of dancing around our general opinions of the story, but as you just mentioned, Charles, this is something where you've got the one of the most recognizable and most beloved duos in Whovian lore, at a point where they are just, they know each other so well. Their chemistry is so positive. Haley, as far as the impressions you've been getting of Sarah Jane from the early stages, you know, taking it from the Time Warrior to this point, where do you feel they are in their journey together, both as characters and just the way that the two actors are carrying themselves on screen to make it entertaining?
I mean, she's been with the Doctor for quite a long run at this point. Mm. I love Sarah Jane. She's pretty fantastic. I get all the fanfare about her.
Yeah.
Before, you know, our little rewatch project, all I'd seen of her was School Reunion. So I was wow. Okay, yeah, well, that's cool. Mm-hmm. Oh, and maybe the one big crossover episode.
Right.
Yeah.
So that was my exposure to her. And at this point, it's the two of them are a pair. You can't really imagine them with anybody else.
You're experiencing Sarah Jane the way Riversong experiences the Doctor.
That's She's getting her the reverse chronology, and it's a great ride. Yeah. Jay, as far as what you know, I mean, you've got the advantage of being able to look a bit ahead, a little bit behind, you know, have a little bit of advanced knowledge of some of the things to come. But as far as their journey together, where would you consider they are as far as, you know, earning the accolades that they now have? Have they already hit that point well before? And everybody knows that this is the fourth and Sarah Jane that really gelled three stories ago or last season or what have you? Or is it still something, you know, oh, you got something to come? And even at this point right now, they haven't really gotten to the, you know, whatever tier of their relationship that you are waiting on.
No, I think that this is peak foreign Sarah Jane. This is when, I mean, they were just getting to it before this story, I feel like, or they had mm-hmm. just reached it or whatever. But this is the point when everyone's like, it's like, you know, what's the deal with the Doctor and Sarah Jane, and this is the perfect instance to be like, this is the sweet spot. This is exactly where you need to go to find that. Mm-hmm. And it is such a great pairing of the two of them because they know each other so well. And it's actually a point in the story, you know, for the Doctor to figure out that Sarah Jane has a problem or whatever. And it is just that absolute, like, you know, these two fit together and it's just perfect.
Yeah. It's an excellent point. The fact that that this requires them both being able to read each other unspoken in order to accomplish some of the things set before them. And also just, you begin the story with them sort of joking around with one another, which is normally something where there's a little bit of banter at the beginning, just sort of get us into whatever our chaos is. Mm-hmm. But even their opening banter in this is delightful. I mean, this just says that these two have become old friends, and you've seen this is shades of the kind of beautiful bond that you had with Pertwee and Joe Grant.
Mm-hmm. By the time season 14 rolls around, and this is the first story from season 14, you've forgotten that Sarah Jane was ever a companion to John Pertwee.
Oh, yeah.
You've forgotten it.
Yeah, that's so true.
She's always been Tom Baker's companion.
Yeah. Yeah, not to take anything away from their work together, but but that was, that felt like work together. Mm-hmm. This is a friendship. Well, as much as we adore everything that we get from our two principals, I always enjoyed the aspect of the story. Well, again, I agree. Yeah, it's not the deepest or the most profound or the most action packed or whatever adjective you want to put in the story, but it's a solid one on
great all around. This would win all around best story, but it's not the most emotional. It's not the most frightening. It's not everything you just said.
Right. But I think one of the things that keeps it on an even keel is the fact that the supporting cast is so rock solid. I genuinely enjoy all of our supporting characters on both sides of the, you know, the tyranny and villainy, and then the heroes and ne'er-do-wells and everything in between. So there's, as my question for each of you is, and if you need to, if you're not really certain on your Italian names or identifying any of them, that's totally fine too, because I get a little bit lost in it too. But who are your real rock stars as far as just making the story entertaining when Baker and Sladen are not on screen or not the focus of attention? Jay, who did you find most entertaining or most engaging?
I enjoyed, I can't remember his name. The uncle.
Count Federico?
Sure. The evil uncle?
Yes, the evil uncle.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
obligatory evil uncle.
Exactly. And Hieronymus. Anytime the two of those two were on screen, I loved how just deliciously evil Hieronymus was and how he played it down to keep the mild-mannered servant or whatever thing going for as long as possible, like well beyond the point that Federico should have been fooled by it. Mm. And he just kept it going the whole time. And Federico's such a, you know, so self-centered that he's just like, all right, yep, nope, everybody worships me. It's fine. And it just, it amused me to no end. I don't even know why, but those two were probably the only ones that I could stand for any period of time outside of, Four and Sarah Jane.
They're two different power mad, and you know, they're very ambitious for power.
Yes.
In two completely different ways. And that, it was a fantastic relationship. Mm.
Charles, would you agree that those are your two, or either one of them or the pair of them are your gold star supporting cast, or are there others that really made the story for you?
One of the things that I really love about this episode is that all the main supporting cast are on par with Elizabeth Sladen in terms of acting. They're all terrific actors. But no, my rock star on this one is John Larrimore, who played Count Federico. Whether he is with Norman Jones, but Jay is right, those two together are quite a team. But whether he's with Norman Jones or not, he's just deliciously bad. And I mean bad as in evil, not bad as in bad acting.
Right. Yeah, I don't think there's any real ham acting in this at all.
No.
It's exactly on par with what the story requires.
It's. I mean, they definitely like go to town on the scenery, but it's not bad.
Yeah, exactly. It all works right. Somehow because they may be larger than life or what have you, but it suits them because that's exactly what they need to be because right. of their character personas. Yeah. Haley, who was really the sort of the shining star as far as the supporting cast?
Hieronymus.
Yeah.
Just, I love Norman a ridiculous Jones. Bad guy.
With a ridiculous beard.
Yes.
He did have a ridiculous beard.
Wow.
He and Tom Baker are very much of a pair. In terms of the way that in terms of their acting styles. And it's always been a hot debate in fandom circles whether Tom Baker actually impersonated Norman in that last scene when he has the mask on.
Oh, yeah.
Or not. So a more careful DVD watching would probably reveal the answer to be no. But, you know, they both have similar voices. And so the answer is could be.
I have a question.
Yeah.
Was there a single woman with a speaking part in this story besides Sarah Jane?
No.
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 Hmm. No. There was a
As it should be in
the Mandragora Sausage Fest.
Well, they do talk a lot about salami in the last scenes.
I know. That was uncomfortable.
Yeah. But no, this is a blatant fault on the part of Lewis Marks for not really wanting to involve any female characters. I don't even understand. There are long swaths of these couple of seasons where this occurs. And Haley, I think you caught this on just a couple of stories ago where it's like, I'm sorry. What did we, hello, this is the, you know, the 52nd century. Have we completely eliminated that other chromosome? What's going on here? So
it's okay. We're in the past before women were invented.
Yeah, I'm gonna rush in to defend one aspect of it. Okay, well, in two ways. First of all, this is in the royal court, mm-hmm. and so therefore women would be scarce. Mm-hmm. So that I think that's historically in line. Although they really could have pushed it a little more. And the other one is Giuliano has Marco, so. No women to be found over there. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, and that was a subtle bit there that I picked up on. I'm glad that you mentioned Marco. That was actually between Marco and over on the flip side of the altercation, Rossini as the Count's second.
Yeah.
I thought were pretty engaging. I mean, you're talking like third tier. This is your C class cast here, and
yes.
I thought they did a great job, particularly Marco. I thought a lot of his scenes through the torture sequence or even in just some of the his sort of hashing things out with Giuliano about the affairs of the state and things of that sort and the importance of maintaining, you know, control over what is supposed to be his dukedom and so forth, what were really credible scenes. Like I sat back and said, if I didn't expect Tom Baker to come busting through the door in about 2.5 minutes, this would be a pretty good historical piece on you know, pick your favorite public broadcasting station.
Well,
I thought that several times that they forgot that they were doing a Doctor Who episode.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, this is throughout the history of Doctor Who, whenever they can do a historical that happens to mirror the similar time period to a production the BBC has just done, well, they have all those sets and all those costumes to play with, and they just go to town.
Yeah,
I do want to mention, I do want to single out Tim Pigott-Smith or Peugeot Smith. I'm not sure how you pronounce his last name. He went on to have an incredibly illustrious acting career. And he was terrific in this as Marco. Gareth Armstrong went on to a much more distinguished stage career, often doing Shakespeare, in fact, as here he's Giuliano. But both of them are outstanding actors. I don't think Gareth had much to do, I mean, in terms of character development in this story, which is a shame, but they're both terrific actors.
Mm-hmm. So through it all, we end up with a – this is a pretty physical episode. Lots of sword fighting, a little bit of wrestling, and you know, you've got some jesters jumping around, a lot of, you know, cool action, things to look at from a visual perspective in that regard. There's also a lot of thumping on the head. Particularly in episode.
It's okay. It's before concussions were invented, too.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, you just shake it off. The first two episodes. Yeah, there's a whole lot of bonk in the head downtime.
No wonder so few people lived to age 50 at that time. Yeah, bonked on the head.
You had to wonder at some point if the doctor wasn't just gonna, somewhere around regen 4, 5, 6, he'd just decide, you know, my costume's gonna involve a helmet. and learn.
Oh, Gallifreyans don't get concussions. That's what it is.
Yeah.
That's...
Well, the Time Lord helmets are pretty thin. And just a little bit of warbler. I almost wanted to develop a drinking game. Just, you know, you get some of these classic episodes, and it's just whenever someone.
Oh my god! Yeah, thumping. You did like an entire series rewatch, like all of season 14, with an unknocked unconscious drinking game.
Yep.
You'd have liver disease.
Yep.
Gallifrey Public Radio does not endorse this activity.
That doesn't sound like us at all.
No, we don't endorse it. We just highly condone it. So, all right. So some technical stuff. I mean, as far as are there moments, are there aspects, you know, we're talking about cast performances and such, but what about other aspects of the story that really that kept it from being, it's kind of a lukewarm, you know, it's a take it or leave it kind of story. If there's anything that really kind of pushes a little more towards the positive, what are some of those elements?
I will certainly say that this is, let's not forget, this is a story written by Lewis Marks, arguably one of the show's best historical writers. Who happens to have been a doctorate in Renaissance studies, by the way.
Okay.
And yet there's so much wrong in historical detail here. And I'm starting with the fact that it's a duchy that's not, you know, the fictional duchy. But that's probably script editor Robert Holmes getting it. Nevertheless, Lewis Marks wrote for Hartnell. Mm. And if Hartnell had been a somewhat younger man, or if you can imagine William Russell doing some of the more physical stuff that the doctor does here, it's still structured a lot like a Hartnell story.
Yeah, okay. I could...
Except a Hartnell story would have had two women with speaking roles.
And the doctor would have been unconscious for two episodes.
Actually, yeah, one of them would just be a screaming role and the other one would be a speaking role.
No, call it three then. Because you always, in a lot of the Hartnell stories, you had a second tier supporting cast character who would come in, who was usually in a lot of the conversations with Barbara specifically, because you know, she going at it with his historian's interest. We're kind of lacking that here. Instead, you've got Baker, who already knows history and keeps name dropping like you're stepping over landmines.
But Robert Holmes was the script editor. Lewis Marks, the writer. Rodney Bennett was the director. I mean, this is the 70s all-star cast here. Mm. Phil Hinchcliffe, the producer. Dudley Simpson, the composer. Oh, my God. These are all the names, right, from all the classics that we love from the 1970s.
Okay.
All in the same room.
Jay, would you say that there are aspects other than individual cast performances that really kept it entertaining or engaging for you?
Yeah, I loved all of the location work, actually. Like, that really stood out to me, and I was really, really enjoying that. Even though I know that it was just in Wales, I fully bought into the fact that it's, like, no, they're in, like, you know, medieval Italy.
Yep. The great stone stairwells, and they're just wide enough to be able to get yourself and a sword through.
Yeah.
That's no fast movements.
What more do you need?
Nah, not much. Doing the little back research on this, you find out that this is also the same location. I'd need to do some sort of like frame by frame comparisons or something, where this is the same location where they shot a vast majority of The Prisoner.
Yes.
So I didn't see anything that was immediately recognizable. Charles, I'm assuming that you're, you know, relatively familiar with The Prisoner as well.
There's a few shots. If you go through the whole of The Prisoner, you will find a few shots. But to the location manager's credit, they did not use all the iconic stuff which The Prisoner had done.
Okay.
And that's because The Prisoner came first. And so they were like, oh, yeah, no, we're not going to use that courtyard. No.
Right.
But you can go through and see, oh, yeah, that doorway, that staircase. Yes, those were in The Prisoner as well.
Cool. I was personally, the thing I was most impressed with were the costumes. And it just struck me every time through. And it wasn't until maybe about the third, fourth time watching it through in earnest that I said, this sits outside of their budget. Even for a period piece, there's a lot, especially when they were doing things like the whole dance sequence in episode 4. I'm like, there's a lot of extras back there. They don't have a wardrobe closet quite that deep for this exact period, you know, Italian, late Renaissance and so forth. And I thought, where is this all coming from? And then I realized, oh, they just boosted the entire wardrobe from Zeffirelli's Romeo and Juliet and did a little bit of quick tailoring, and they had an amazing costume closet to tap
into. Yeah, the Zeffirelli Romeo and Juliet, if you've never seen that, it is stunning. Yeah. And one of my all-time favorite films. So seeing those costumes again is always gives me the warm fuzzies as well. This story is also it is its own thing, but it follows Hamlet pretty well. There's an inexperienced prince and a power-mad uncle, and a debate about science and religion.
But thankfully, Giuliano does not go insane.
No.
Okay. But, oh, he was also a good swordsman. There you go. You got that too.
Yep. There you go.
It also kind of follows the Lion King.
Yes. Yes. Complete with headpiece.
Well, the Lion King also borrows from Hamlet.
Which borrows from the Odyssey.
Yes.
And on, so it will be forever without end. All right. And last little piece of phenomenal trivia, what I think invaluable trivia, knowing that Liz Sladen was about to leave during the close of season 13. But when the opportunity, when she had heard the opportunity that she was going to be able to do this particular piece, I don't know if it was the period nature of it that attracted to her or what it was. Maybe that's something to find out for another time. Charles, I don't know if you know any more about the inkling behind this, but she decided to stay on for another 7 months.
All I can add to this is that the producers didn't want her to go, but she was worried about typecasting and was, I think, right to be worried about that. But they were just such a great pair. And it was typical, very typical, for companions to stay no longer than two seasons. So she'd already done all that time by this point.
Right.
So it was perfectly normal for her to want to move on, get back to the stage, do whatever she wanted to do. But they didn't want her to go. And, yeah, I think the script – or maybe she was just dying to know the answer of why they can understand all these people speaking Italian. But whatever it was, I think she had the opportunity to review the script and go, you know what, I'm not giving this to anybody else. This is mine.
One of the most blatant drops of the I'll explain it to you later tropes.
Right.
And you saw it coming. You stepped out off the curb. You saw the headlights coming at you. You thought, I'm about to get hit in the shins. And you stood there and took it anyway. Yeah. All right. Let's get to our sort of wrap up here. As far as how rewatchable is the story and how recommendable, if that is a word, it is now because it's on the internet. what's the recommendability of this particular story for people who are looking to build their knowledge of classic Who. Haley, I led off with your first impressions with you, so I'll hand this to you first.
I think if you're somebody that likes, you know, the historical Doctor Who stories and you don't want a big scary monster in it, this is a good one. I don't know. It didn't stand out to me, though, as like, oh, this is one you've got to grab to recommend it to, you know, to somebody.
Okay.
Like, oh, are they going to be into Doctor Who? I don't see anything in particular in this story that's like, oh, yes, this one. This is the one you must see.
Gotcha. Charles?
Well, as I said before, if you're looking for a story with no backstory that is a good intro piece to the Tom Baker era, this and maybe Ark in Space are both excellent choices for that. The City of Death and so on. But yeah, I find it, of course, I find it very rewatchable. But then I love Italian cinema and opera and all things Italian. So for me, that's just bonus on the cake. Plus, Doctor Who's first gay couple. Come on.
Yeah.
You gotta like that.
Yeah. Well, as far as explicit.
Blatant. Yeah. Yeah.
Jay, where are you on the rewatch and and recommend scale?
Rewatchability? Yeah, it's not one that I'm probably going to, well, I don't know.
But it's fun.
I've got to be like in the right mood to actually seek this out, but it's not one that I'm ever going to be like, oh God, not this one again and turn off.
Oh yeah.
Right. Yeah. So yeah, I'd rewatch it. As far as recommendability goes, for all of the reasons that Charles picked it for to show his wife, same thing. You know, you don't need the background. It's just it's peak Baker and Sladen.
Yep.
It's fun. It's just a fun episode that you can go in and like, hey, yeah, that was a thing. You can either continue watching or go about your business. It doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I would say recommendability with those. For those reasons.
Mm. And looks pretty gorgeous.
Yeah.
It is a very pretty story. Rewatchable, certainly. If it's there, if I'm going through the full DVD set or Blu-ray set, sure, absolutely. You know, I got no problem with that. Recommendability, probably not. For a couple of reasons. One, it's not one that really, you know, if you are picking and choosing, and you're giving people a set, this is not one that I'd want to include necessarily in a set because I'd probably be giving them a specific set because I had an agenda and this would not be part of that agenda. Not to mention the fact, as Haley noted, it's pretty stilted and it doesn't really give a chance for a more diverse cast to really shine. There are other examples of stories that do a far better job of being able, even within the Baker era, of being able to give you a set that everyone can identify and appreciate. So,
yeah. On reconsideration, yeah, if the person you're wanting to show this to is female or just woke, maybe not. Mm.
Yeah, not first. I feel like there are better first episodes.
Yeah.
Depending on your target audience.
Yeah. This could be something, this is one of those things that sort of fills in, once you get somebody hooked, then you can give this to them and say, here's some, here's a little between meal snack.
Mm.
So
there you go. Yeah. So are we ready for the news?
I'm feeling rather news, not worthy. What's the eager for news? News wanty. I'm news wanty.
What?
It's a word now. It's on the internet. Damn it. We already established this.
Oh, so what are we going to start with here?
Well, we should probably take a moment just to address a loss that not only the Whovian community had, but the film and television community at large. A lot of times, modern Whovians, when they hear the last name Shepard, they immediately go to Mark, and they think of all his, and then it spirals out from there. You think of his work within Doctor Who, and then we think Supernatural, and then we think Battlestar Galactica, and we go on and on and on and on and on. But the Shepard family has a legend in its pantheon, and we lost their father figure this past week. Charles, you want to sort of expound a little bit?
W. Morgan Shepherd is Mark Shepherd's father and played Kent Everett Delaware's father in The Impossible Astronaut, Day of the Moon. And he also had an extensive career beyond that. He trained at the Royal Academy of Dramatic Arts. He was an associate artist with the Royal Shakespeare Company for 12 years. He was on Star Trek The Next Generation. He was on Star Trek Voyager. He was in the film Star Trek VI. He was on the 2009 reboot of Star Trek. He was in Babylon 5, two different roles. When I first met him, it was because he had done Blank Reg in the comedy Max Headroom.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Right? He was Blank Reg. He had the mohawk. And I met him when I was over in England. He was shooting something else. And we managed to have a little coffee and stuff, and we talked mostly about that role, and it was just delightful. And he was delightful. He's every bit as charming as it. He worked pretty steadily for a very long time. And I forget exactly how old he is, but something in mid-80s. And it's a terrible loss. But he was a terrific character actor. And don't worry, he'll pop up in something you're rewatching.
Yeah, without question. As far as to bring things to a lighter note, we have some things to look forward to. Well, it seems like a bit of foreshadowing for what we're going to be talking about next week, which we'll get to momentarily. But the yet another announcement from Big Finish about things that are going to be dropped into our hands in the not too distant future. If you have any money left. Seriously, at this point, because it's getting ridiculous. just Jay and I just keep kind of looking at each other and saying, I'm not picking up a third job. I'm not doing it.
Yeah.
I refuse.
I know.
I don't know if this is going to be the last foray into their Time War, pocket that they've been allowed to work within over the last year and a half, 2 years or so. But it's definitely one of the biggest because it finally sort of culminates some of the things that they've done. They've taken the Time War work that they've finally allowed Paul McGann to bring the Eighth Doctor into and mm-hmm. do a couple of series with that. They are now doing another installment. I guess this kind of technically falls under this series of the War Master series. So you've got Sir Derek Jacobi.
Thank you.
As our War Master, so taking the Yana Master, if you will, been doing phenomenal work with that, and now allowing the two of them to play in the same sandbox.
Wow. Man, Paul McGann and Derek Jacobi. The hairs on the back of my neck just stood up.
Yeah. Wow. Now, granted, I will say that my wish and my dream back when I knew that they were first going to start to do something with the Time War was when they had announced that they were going to be working with the War Doctor, and Sir John Hurt had done his first his first installment of it. Only the Monstrous, I think, was the name of the series, or might have been. My hope was that he was going to get an opportunity to square off against an iteration of the Master. This was before they had decided that they were going to do the Time Master and bring Sir Derek into it. Mm-hmm. But man, as much as I'm looking forward to this particular one, the back of my brain is just itching and saying, what would have happened with Sir John Hurt and Sir Derek Jacobi?
Cool.
It's one of those things.
Clash
where,
of the Sirs. Dun, dun, dun.
You just kind of wonder, you know, what parallel universe do you have to just sort of sidestep into? Go ahead and do your pre-order on that. I will say I have noticed pre-orders are getting a little bit cheaper.
Yeah. I think they're starting to push the download side a bit more. Mm. And for those of you who haven't bought every single Big Finish story yet. As usual, at the moment they're holding a sale. They very often have sales. You should really take advantage of those and get those downloads when they do.
Yeah. Sales are getting very aggressive right now because they are, as we're coming into the 20th anniversary season. So it gives them an opportunity to be able to really, really – and they're capitalizing on this kind of, down year –
I'm sorry to contradict you, but they just got nominated for one of the BBC's Audio Awards mm-hmm. for one of their original series, not one of the Doctor Who's or any of the licensed series, one of their originals. Mm-hmm. And so they are having a big sale on all of their original stuff.
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I'm just saying they're going to be able to – they're going to see the surge in interest because of the fact that you've got people who are spiraling out there to try to find something new to enjoy. And now they've got the opportunity to be able to work with some characters, you know, if it's River Song, if it's the War Master, if it's a matter of, you know, the Paternoster Gang or any of the other characters that they've been given the opportunity to be able to work with a Doctor's Daughter. You know, things of that sort.
Yeah.
All kinds of stuff. So it gives you a chance to be able to further explore your favorite pocket of Who. So
I'm still waiting for a series, an entire box set, of The Tribe of Gum. I mean, the Tribe, The Adventures of The Tribe.
That's a long wait.
We'll have to recast the old mother, of course.
Last little piece of awesome news, because we are within, we're just about at a month away, a month and a couple of days as we're recording here, the 30th anniversary, 30th iteration of Gallifrey One, and a little gift we've been handed today, that just said that our panels are going to get a little bit raunchier all around. That's all you need to know.
Yep.
Oh, why?
This is going to be an especially sexy year.
It will. Jay, please enlighten me.
Well, we're actually getting two new names added to the list at Gallifrey One. Mr. John Barrowman.
Barrowman!
If you haven't heard all of the crazy places that he has put his penis on the sets of various shows, you're going to learn at least three just standing in the corridors.
Yep. He won't be adding to that list.
I don't know.
Eh.
It's a different time.
But also our favorite, memory challenged companion, Donna Noble, Miss Catherine Tate will be there as well.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. It's just adding to an already incredible roster. I will say I have not had enough opportunities to be able to hear Catherine Tate speak on panels at events that I've been at. Obviously, there's plenty of video footage out there. But she's been doing a wonderful tour. She is so approachable. I've known so many people who have just sort of passed her in hallways and said, do you mind just for a second? I just wanted to ask. And as long as you're not being impolite, not asking for photos and things of that sort, and her handler gives her a second, if you're just dying to know, when you were working on this Shakespearean production or what have you, she's given them so much time to just chit chat. She's so delightful. I can't wait. I cannot wait for this.
Yeah. And this joins the approximately 800 other guests.
Yes. It's actually now a 10-day con.
It should. Well, don't say that to Sean. He will kill you. But just the sheer number of people that are going to be there is absolutely stunning.
Yeah. The only downside to this is that it's just going to make your personal scheduling hell.
Oh, yeah.
Because there's just no way you can get to everyone that you want to hear from. You just can't do it. One of these days, Galley is going to have to start to go the route of some of the big OmniCons like DragonCon, where they've got closed circuit television, and even as you're getting ready in your room in the morning or you're winding down in the evenings, you can see either footage from some of the panel rooms that you can't get to, or you can see video recaps of the panels you missed that day. Nothing that you can record, nothing you can walk away with or rebroadcast or things of that sort, but you can just watch it in your hotel room.
All I can tell you about that is that I don't think Sean would ever let that happen. Mm. He's very determined not to turn this into a Comic-Con.
Yeah. Well, I don't really see it as a Comic-Con thing. Well, anyway, I digress. But yeah, I had already been excited about Gallifrey 1 for 1,000 reasons. This is just 1,002.
Yeah.
Yeah, very much so. Well, next week, we're going to be talking about the fact that we already want this year to be over because there's no new Doctor Who. But there are plenty of other things that we can do to fill our time. And we're going to talk about the various ways that you can still get your Who fix, even when Chibnall's being a withholding punk.
Well, it's his pace. It's his pace. As our friend Graham from over at Reality Bomb reminded me the other day, he says, you do got to bear in mind that this is a showrunner who, until the 11th hour last year, didn't even confirm that they were going to call the show Doctor Who. So, point well made.
Valid.
Okay. Also, for various reasons, the BBC have play a role in this too. So you can't entirely, this is not something you can entirely blame Chibnall for.
No. Well, true. You could, but you might not be entirely.
What's the point in having a showrunner if we're not going to blame them for everything?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
That's the job description.
The title says you're gonna take the show and run with it. So run, you ruddy bugger, run.
Well, one bonus activity that you can do to get your Who fix in is actually go and give us a rating or review on iTunes. It really helps us to get the name out there and bring more people into the community. So please head over there if you haven't done so already. Give us a number of stars. The more the better for us anyway.
Yeah.
And you know, maybe tell us how we're doing. It's up to you. However much time you have. But this has been episode 317 of Gallifrey Public Radio. Until next week, this is Jay saying, if you had told me what fancy dress meant, I wouldn't have shown up in a tux.
And this is Gear saying, you don't have to use that 15th century double talk with me. I speak it a pretty good English.
This is Charles saying, you humans have such limited little minds. I don't know why I like you.
And this is Haley saying, don't listen to Jay. I endorse all of the drinking games.
We'll see you guys next week.
Allons-y.
Cheers.
Bye.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of Gallifrey Public Radio. Join us each week for new episodes. We love getting feedback from listeners, so don't hesitate to share your thoughts with us. You can email us at feedback@gallifreypublicradio.com, tell us on Twitter @GallifreyRadio, or on Facebook at facebook.com/GallifreyPublicRadio. You can also leave us a voicemail for inclusion in future shows at 210-802-1477. That's 210-802-1GPR. You should also go to GunnaGeek.com and check out lots of other high-quality geek-centric shows, or visit forums.GunnaGeek.com to talk about anything geeky with us or the community.
All right. Well, next year or next week.
next year. Damn it, January.
All right.
We're already looking forward to 2019 being over.
This is our one episode of 2019.
See ya, deuces.
All right. Well,
we start pre-production next week on.
Yeah, we got a lot of sets to build for the podcast.
I've saved so much cardboard from Amazon. Guys, we're ready.
Also, apparently it's summertime in Wales. So.
Yeah, there you go. Get out on it.
Timey-wimey. Yeah.